radioactive nuclear waste. While the nukesters and their enablers in government push for building more power reactors, more bombs, and restarting shuttered reactors, they conveniently ignore the deadly radioactive byproduct of this process, highly radioactive, health-damaging nuclear waste. And we, the people, have been conditioned since before the Trinity test in New Mexico in 1945, the start of the atomic age, to ignore radiation released by splitting the atom. So pro-nukers get away with their rah-rah money grab and lies about nukes being green and the way to fight climate change by redirecting our attention away from the genuinely forever dangers that they create. It takes a truly knowledgeable, genuine expert to boil down the problem. And when he tells you,
"So radioactive waste remained dangerous for millions of years. They are the most toxic waste ever produced by any industry ever. They are essentially indestructible. Countless billions of dollars are planned to be spent to keep these materials out of the food we eat, the water we drink, and the air we breathe. At Hanford in Washington State, just north of California, the radioactive cleanup is estimated to cost more than $300 billion, according to the General Accounting Office. By building more reactors, we're just adding to the existing burden. In fact, you could say the real product of a nuclear reactor is radioactive waste and plutonium, which remains dangerous for millions of years. The electricity is just a little blip, a short-term benefit for a few decades. The radioactive legacy lasts forever."
Well, when Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility spells it out that clearly, and he's got not only the expertise but the footnotes to back up everything he says, it will take an enormous blind spot, situational amnesia, or flat-out hatred for life itself for anyone to not understand the true nature of that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevy. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we celebrate a recent one-day symposium on radioactive waste, growing threats, emerging solutions. It was produced by the Samuel Lawrence Foundation in cooperation with the Scripps Oceanography Institute and presented at the University of California, San Diego on July 24, 2024. We'll hear more from Dr. Gordon Edwards, as well as statements by Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, Rear Admiral Len Herring, frontline activist Gary Hedrick of San Clemente Green, and many more. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, the ICANN update direct from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons in Geneva, Switzerland, and more honest nuclear information than has yet been heard from the Democratic nominee for President of the United States. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 30th, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. We start with this breaking story. Energy Fuels has begun hauling uranium ore from the Pinyon Plain Mine to their processing mill in Blanding, Utah, as of July 30th, 2024. Originally, the company agreed to provide the Forest Service with at least 2 weeks' notice prior to hauling the ore, but instead provided no advance notice and contacted the Forest Service only after the haul trucks had already left the mine site. Since the mine's reopening, Navajo Nation has continuously opposed their hauling uranium through its reservation. And now comes word that President of Navajo Nation, Boo Nigrin, has deployed Navajo police to stop the illegal transport of uranium across the reservation. President Nigrin said, "The lack of notification to the Navajo Nation is a blatant disregard for our tribal sovereignty and exposes our Diné people to toxic uranium, a substance that has devastated our community for decades. I have ordered the Navajo Nation police to escort the transport vehicles off our land." We'll have more on this story on next week's Nuclear Hot Seat. In California, environmental groups are outraged at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's irresponsible decision to deny a public hearing on crucial safety issues in the license renewal application process of Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. These include seismic risks, vulnerability of critical reactor pressure vessel to rupture, and non-compliance with coastal regulations. A coalition of San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, Friends of the Earth, and Environmental Working Group have appealed to the commissioners of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission to reverse a hearing board decision, which denies a public hearing. Diane Curran, legal counsel for the petitioners, said, "Insulating PG&E's unsafe operation of Diablo Canyon from public scrutiny to determine whether the plant can operate safely puts millions of people in California at risk if a meltdown should occur." Down the coast of California to San Onofre, where on July 25th, almost 120,000 gallons of radioactive water from San Onofre were released into the Pacific Ocean, and notification was only given after this action was completed. More on the dangers of radioactive waste in today's feature. Regarding the Palisades nuclear reactor in Michigan, the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said during a congressional hearing how he expects the agency's review of a request to restart the 1970s-era nuclear reactor on Lake Michigan to be wrapped up by May, and expects that if approved, as expected, the plant could be operating as soon as August 2025. Buried in this article was the nuclear industry suggestion that rather than calling the process a nuclear plant decommissioning restart, it should be dubbed or rebranded recommissioning. Doesn't that sound so much nicer? Doesn't change the fact that it's a really bad idea. By the way, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had to develop a new bureaucratic process to decide whether to allow a nuclear plant that began decommissioning and was in total shutdown mode for 2 years to be returned to service. Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog at Beyond Nuclear, criticized the NRC's efforts to properly review the restart request, saying, "NRC's steady march towards rubber-stamping Holtec's unprecedented, insanely expensive for the public, and extremely high-risk zombie reactor restart shows that the agency has never been more captured by the industry it is supposed to regulate than it is now." And all of this begs the question, do you want to pay for the most expensive electricity on Earth? Then go nuclear. Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
People of Georgia have a message for us. And when I say Georgia, I mean the people of Georgia right here in the USA. It's more of a warning, actually, and it goes like this. If you are supporting the building of new nuclear power plants, get ready to pay for the most expensive electricity on Earth. The warning comes in the form of a lawsuit filed by two groups, Georgia Conservation Education Fund and Georgia WAND, after, according to their allegations, the state deliberately postponed elections for a new public service commission, allowing the current commission to rubber stamp the largest utility rate increases in Georgia history. This has also opened the way for utility companies to charge Georgians for the massive cost overruns and technical screw-ups at the Vogtle 3 and 4 new nuclear site, sending a warning about the skyrocketing charges ratepayers can expect from new nuclear projects. All of this stems from the decision to build two new Westinghouse AP1000 reactors at the Vogtle site, already home to Units 1 and 2. Units 3 and 4 took more than twice as long to build than projected, 15 years in all. The costs also more than doubled, topping out at $36.8 billion. These so-called flagships are the only survivors from the infamous nuclear renaissance of 2007, a moniker of extreme hubris and laughable overstatement that saw 32 other new reactor projects bite the dust. An earlier report by six Georgia consumer groups, Plant Vogel, The True Cost of Nuclear Power in the United States, revealed how the U.S. Department of Energy, Georgia Power, and the Georgia Public Service Commission conspired to force Georgians into purchasing the most expensive electricity in the world. How much are they paying for their new nuclear power? $10,784 per kilowatt. What does wind or solar cost by contrast? $900 to $1,500 per kilowatt. We don't have to say, do the math here. The contrast is both obvious and breathtaking. For the privilege of choosing nuclear power over renewables, Georgia consumers have been rewarded with a bill increase of as much as 30 to 40%. But wait, I hear you say, surely the new promised reactors are all much smaller, so won't they be much cheaper? It sounds logical, but actually the opposite is true, because so many small reactors would be needed to provide the same output as one large one, hundreds, if not thousands, will have to be manufactured. That requires a factory and someone to invest in it, and it requires buyers. So far, the small modular reactor landscape is pretty bare, and there is already one gravesite when the much-vaunted UAMPS NuScale SMR project collapsed due to ballooning costs. This shouldn't have been a surprise, given that the small modular reactor is not a new concept and has been rejected for decades precisely because of the extreme costs. So in a game of would you rather pay the highest electricity rates possible for a technology that can contribute virtually nothing to climate mitigation and could melt down and render your community uninhabitable? Or would you rather pay for cheaper, faster, and safer renewable energy instead? The Georgia lawsuit is doing its part to make the answer to that question all the more obvious. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Internationally, the U.S. has reaffirmed its nuclear commitment to defend Japan by reinforcing what is called extended deterrence, which is in defiance to China's demands on nukes. Extended deterrence is a commitment to deter and to respond to potential nuclear and non-nuclear scenarios in defense of allies and partners. This is also known as the nuclear umbrella. The U.S. and Japan plan to compile their first joint document on extended deterrence within a year, and it will be specific on what circumstances Tokyo should face in order for Washington to retaliate with nukes. China's state-run newspaper Global Times claimed the U.S. considered deploying nukes in Japan, which would see the Asian country viewed as a nuclear weapons state. It said Tokyo was ready to be considered a potential nuclear target due to its alliance with Washington. The Federation of American Scientists has estimated that another 100 tactical nukes, which are stored in the U.S., would be used in support of allies in Northeast Asia. France's nuclear power regulator has extended temporary waivers, allowing five power stations to continue discharging hot water into rivers as the country contends with a fourth heat wave of summer and an energy crisis. High river temperatures in recent weeks threatened to reduce France's already low nuclear output at a time when nearly half its reactors are offline because of corrosion problems and maintenance. Regulations typically require nuclear production be limited during times of high heat to prevent the hot discharge waters re-entering the rivers from endangering wildlife. Also, it's often not cool enough to actually cool the reactors. This problem often comes up in the U.S. as well, specifically Turkey Point in Florida, but no word of any impact of the heat on the reactors there. Now here is our monthly ICAN update on the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons and the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Reporting from ICAN headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland, is Lucero Oyarzun, Digital Campaign Coordinator, sitting in for Alistair Burnett.
Hi, this is Lucero Oyarzun at ICAN in Geneva, and here's a roundup of news from the campaign for July. Right now, diplomats from all over the world have gathered at the UN in Geneva for the Preparatory Committee of the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, or NPT PrepCom. So far, there's been a lot of finger-pointing and deflecting rhetoric from the five nuclear weapons states and their allies, who are all keen to ignore their own contributions to the current nuclear arms race and the heightened risk. Earlier this month, we heard very similar messaging come out of NATO's 75th anniversary summit in Washington, D.C., where the mantra, as long as nuclear weapons exist, NATO will remain a nuclear alliance, was reiterated while simultaneously reaffirming NATO's commitment to disarmament in the same statement. Luckily, we've also heard many states at the NPT PrepCom cut through this contradictory rhetoric. In a particularly strong statement calling out nuclear deterrence and nuclear sharing, the states' parties and signatories to the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, also highlighted the treaty's complementarity to the disarmament goals of the NPT and urged all states to join it. Of course, civil society representatives from around the world are also in the room to support these points, to stress the risks and the humanitarian consequences of nuclear weapons, and put pressure on the states to actually work towards the total elimination. The NPT closes on August 2nd, and we will see in the coming week if anything comes out of this session. Staying in Switzerland, the Swiss Alliance for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons launched a new public initiative at the beginning of the month to increase the public pressure on the Swiss federal government to join the TPNW. ICANN is a member of this alliance, so I'm joined by my colleague Florian Ebelenkamp, who can tell us more. Welcome, Florian. I think we need to start with some background. Why hasn't Switzerland joined the Nuclear Weapons Ban Treaty yet? They've been strong supporters of the humanitarian argument for a ban from the start, and they were key in getting the treaty adopted in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. Swiss diplomats were instrumental in bringing this treaty about and voted in favor of its adoption in 2017. After that, even the parliament of Switzerland voted in favor of signing and ratifying that treaty, but the government has since not followed suit. And in March this year, they announced again that they will delay joining this treaty. And since we ran out of sort of parliamentary and political options, we now launched a Swiss popular initiative together with a large alliance of other civil society organizations here in Switzerland.
Can you explain a bit more about how an initiative like this works? Switzerland is renowned for its participative democracy, but for us non-Swiss folk, it can be hard to know the step-by-step.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is truly unique that every political decision by the government or the parliament is subject to a popular vote. So if there's a significant part of the population that doesn't agree with what the government does, there can always be an initiative or a referendum. So what we're doing now is collect 100,000 signatures within 18 months. So if there's any Swiss listeners out there, make sure you sign up to the initiative. After that, the initiative goes to the parliament to formulate its opinion, and then to the government to also issue an opinion. There might be a counter proposal, so that delays the process a lot. But eventually, if the government still refuses to sign the treaty, there will be a popular vote, a referendum on joining the TPNW. And that's quite a cool step in terms of grassroots campaigning for nuclear disarmament, that you can actually force a government to join this treaty by popular acclamation.
We've reached the point to hit the streets and start up conversations to get 100,000 people on board. What does this look like for the alliance, and what is the part you're most excited about?
Yeah, so actually many of our Swiss partner organizations that are part of this alliance are now on the streets, at music festivals, at popular spots in the cities, at train station and so on, to collect signatures. It's very exciting because usually we talk to diplomats and government officials and maybe parliamentarians who are used to a very specific kind of terminology around nuclear weapons, to some slightly abstract reasons for nuclear weapons policies. But now it's actually talking to normal people, and then the question usually gets reduced to, are you for nuclear weapons or against? And that's really what the TPNW is about as well. So I think that's very exciting that, you know, we're open public discussing nuclear weapons, which usually doesn't happen so much. If you want to find more about the initiative, check out the website of the alliance. In French, it's interdiction-arme-nucléaire.ch, and in German, of course, atomwaffenverbot.ch. And you'll find all the information to sign in.
That was Florian Ebelenkamp, advocacy officer at ICANN. For more information about the Swiss initiative, the NPT, and a joint statement from former senior NATO political and military figures calling on NATO to wean itself off being a nuclear alliance dependent on outdated deterrence strategy, check out the news section on our website, ICANNW.org. And if you want to follow the action from the room as the NPT unfolds, don't forget to follow Reaching Critical Will on Twitter, check out the hashtag NPTPrepCom, or hop on UN Web TV for the live stream. This is Lucero Yersun with news from ICANN for July.
That was the ICANN update with Lucero Oyarzun sitting in for Alistair Burdett. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, nuclear kills two ways, fast and slow. We've been conditioned to think of nuclear dangers as solely those of the bomb. The fireball, intense heat, mushroom cloud, immediate annihilation. But ongoing danger comes from the release of ionizing nuclear radiation into the environment. That's what creates the greatest nuclear risk to our health, safety, and our DNA. The steady release of radiation around the country from uranium mining, uranium refinement, manufacture of reactor fuel rods, reactor operations, accidents, intentional dumping of radioactive tritium-contaminated water into the Pacific by Japan, as well as everything around weapons. And then there's the forever dangers of used nuclear fuel that is dangerously radioactive for 500,000 years. All of this creates ongoing, ever-increasing nuclear risks to the health and safety of people and the environment. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat, because mainstream media does not cover these issues with any specificity or any ongoing context. We don't mess around here. Every week we get into nuclear stories with facts, continuity, and context, providing you with a deep and nuanced telling of our shared nuclear situation. But to continue to do this work, we need your help. Nuclear Hot Seat runs on donations, and without them, we can't survive. So help us out with a donation of any size, be it one time, or you can set up a recurring donation for as little as $5 a month. That's what sustains us. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donations are tax deductible. Just go to Nuclear Hot Seat and click on the red donate button. And if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please, donate now. And whatever you can do to help, know that I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's special report. Radioactive nuclear waste is a plague on all our houses. The forever threat of damage to our health, safety, and even the genetic future of our human race, because radiation damages DNA. The nuclear industry keeps flogging their deadly product as a miracle cure for climate change. It's not. While ignoring the stream of deadly radioactive waste they produce that cannot be neutralized and for which there is no long-term safe storage. The Samuel Lawrence Foundation, in cooperation with the Scripps Oceanography Institute, held a one-day symposium on radioactive wastes from nuclear reactors in San Diego, California, on July 24, 2024, entitled Radioactive Waste, Growing Threats, Emerging Solutions. The symposium featured a stunning lineup of more than two dozen speakers from around the country, including former Nuclear Regulatory Commission Chair Greg Yatsko, environmental expert Mark Z. Jacobson, Indigenous community organizer Leona Morgan, energy efficiency expert Amory Lovins, several oceanographers, and many more experts in a wide range of disciplines. At the time of production of this episode, most of their recordings were still being processed and will be featured in future episodes of Nuclear Hot Seat, as well as on the Samuel Lawrence Foundation YouTube channel. But here is a glimpse of who was there, what was said, and where we go from here. Because of our location, much of what was said focused on the problems at the shuttered San Onofre Nuclear Power Station, which is unfortunately referred to as some by its initials, SONGS, so that when we oppose it, it sounds like we don't like music. First, Congressman Mike Levin of the 49th Congressional District in Southern California. He covers the southern coastal areas of San Diego and Orange counties and includes San Onofre, and that includes San Onofre. He was unable to be present, but sent a video message of support. In part, he said, quote, "There are 1,600 tons of spent fuel at SONGS. The fuel sits just 100 feet from the Pacific Ocean on an active fault line and near Camp Pendleton Marine Base. It is also near very heavy populated areas, San Diego, Los Angeles, and Orange County. And the current situation, the status quo, is neither safe nor effective in the long term." A statement by Congressman Mike Levin of the 49th Congressional District in Southern California. Another politician and supporter of our efforts is Larry Agron. He is vice mayor of the city of Irvine and a candidate for mayor. We spoke before the symposium began.
My name's Larry Agron. I'm speaking this morning at this gathering regarding the importance of developing a California state plan for the safe storage of nuclear waste.
What is your position in the world that brings you to prominence on this issue?
I'm a longtime local elected official, a public interest attorney. I'm currently vice mayor in the city of Irvine and have had a longstanding abiding interest in San Onofre and its various dangers as it was producing electricity and now, of course, as it's storing nuclear waste.
Given that you're here and basically in the thick of it, what do you hope to achieve or accomplish based on this event and then moving forward?
Well, I'm hoping that we will actually have legislation to introduce in January at the state level, where the legislature gives direction to the governor, his administration, to develop a CalSafe nuclear waste storage plan, providing for the safe storage of nuclear waste, which would entail a plan to address, obviously, the dangers that are there right now. We have no plan in the state of California. That's the point. We have absolutely no plan to keep people safe in all of Southern California from an accident or catastrophic accident at the San Onofre site under current circumstances.
And does there exist a plan anywhere in the world that you know of that could prove a model for this, or is California taking the lead?
No, I think in the United States anyway, California would be taking the lead. We do not have a national repository. There's certainly no international repository for stored nuclear waste. In this case, California needs a plan to remedy the unsafe storage that exists now. How do we basically move the stored nuclear waste to higher ground on the Camp Pendleton base in a way that would at least keep us safe for the next 100 years?
From your mouth to somebody in power's ears.
I hope.
Larry Agron, vice mayor of the city of Irvine and a candidate for mayor. Next, I spoke with Rear Admiral Len Herring, a prominent military and civilian sustainability leader with a broad background in energy and environmental issues. Admiral Len Herring, what brings you here to this event today and what will you be addressing?
Well, I'm here because I am the co-chair of the Congressman Levin Task Force on Zones. And what I will be addressing here today are the administrative shortfalls that we've experienced through study between the NRC and those individuals responsible for storing the material. The lack of action and conversation for safety, the shortfalls necessary in order to maintain security, safety, and more importantly, emergency response, which has been waived by the NRC, so nobody knows really what needs to happen if there should be an accident.
What, if anything, do you think is going to be the solution to these problems?
I think the solution to the problem is events like this, but more importantly, getting elected officials involved so that they understand the consequences that these individuals who are here today, experts within the community, have failed to get the necessary answers to make sure that it is safe. We have the ability, although they've neglected to push the energy company and the NRC because it's a federal issue, but the state has a responsibility to protect its citizens. And there's the conflict in the two constitutions. I think the state needs to be more involved in making sure that the NRC and the federal government do its due diligence and ensure that the people are protected without doubt. There's no such thing as slim chance when it comes to nuclear issues.
Admiral Len Herring. His comments during the symposium were stunning in their clarity, and I look forward to bringing them to you in the near future. Next, Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear was there. He has been a leading spokesperson in nuclear reactor hazards and security concerns for more than 30 years.
Talking with Paul Gunter from Beyond Nuclear. Paul, what brings you out here for this incredible event today?
The fact is that the U.S. Government Accountability Project recently provided a report to Congress that basically says that the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not consider climate change impacts on nuclear power plant operations. They've eliminated it from their licensing review process for environmental consequences of sea level rise, of increased severity of hurricanes, but they're now licensing new reactors. It's their intent to do that without looking at the impact of climate change, and it's also that they're relicensing nuclear power stations out to 80 years without considering climate change. And this is negligence that looks to change the mission statement of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission from promoting public health and safety and environmental protection to benefiting the promotional aspect of nuclear power.
And isn't that the essence of what was just in the ADVANCE Act, the inappropriately named ADVANCE Act, that was signed into law by President Biden?
Yes. And again, this is the same act that provides for the nuclear industry expanded limited liability from nuclear accidents, where they've now extended Price-Anderson out to 2065, which protects their assets from being sued in the event of a Fukushima accident here in the United States. But it also gives limited liability for nuclear designs that are supposedly inherently safe. So that shows that they have no confidence in this claim of walk away safe from nuclear power plants that are only paper designs right now, but their cap on liability is only a fraction of what the real cost is from what we've seen from Fukushima, which is running into $300 billion now, projected costs, where the new liability cap is at $16 billion.
So by being here at this event and addressing us so compellingly and looking forward, what do you hope to accomplish here, and what can we do going forward?
Well, this is an event that is, again, a public education opportunity. It's being recorded. We'll see that this work has legs that reaches out beyond just the attending audience. But it's brought together a really excellent panel, a set of panels, actually, that are part of the time mark on a movement that needs to grow beyond just this room.
Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear. One of the featured speakers via Zoom was Dr. Gordon Edwards. He is a mathematician, physicist, and founder of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. Here are his remarks. He is being interviewed by Lance Gould, a journalist and founder of Brooklyn Story Lab, a media strategy firm.
San Onofre nuclear power plant, known as SONGS, was permanently shut down in 2013 and began decommissioning in 2014, about a decade ago. The name of this panel is, again, Why Are We Worried? So please tell us precisely why we should indeed be worried.
Well, thanks, Lance. That's a good question. If nuclear power were just generating electricity and nothing else, it would be safe. But it's also mass-producing deadly radioactive poisons that were never found in nature before the nuclear age began, just 85 years ago. For instance, if you look at nuclear fuel, it can be safely handled before it goes into the reactor. But after it comes out, it is millions of times more radioactive, and it will kill any nearby human being in a matter of seconds by an enormous blast of gamma radiation. So what makes the used fuel suddenly so dangerous? Well, inside the fuel, there are literally hundreds of brand new varieties of radioactive elements that were created by the splitting of uranium atoms. For example, you might have heard of iodine-131, cesium-137, strontium-90. These are radioactive varieties of non-radioactive elements that exist in nature all around us. They're human-made radioactive poisons. They're sort of like evil twins. For example, if you look at ordinary table salt, it has a little bit of iodine added to it. It's not radioactive. It goes to the thyroid gland and helps to prevent a terrible disfiguring disease called goiter. Well, nuclear plants produce radioactive iodine. It also goes to the thyroid gland and causes cancer. 6,000 children in Belarus had to have their thyroid gland surgically removed because of radioactive iodine from the Chernobyl accident of 1986. In northern England and Wales, for 30 years after Chernobyl, sheep farmers could not sell their meat for human consumption when it was contaminated with radioactive cesium. To this day, hunters in Germany and Austria who kill a wild boar cannot eat the meat because of radioactive cesium contamination. You know, everything is made up of atoms. The only difference is that radioactive atoms explode. It's called an atomic disintegration. Radioactive atoms are like little time bombs. If they explode inside you, they damage living cells, especially DNA molecules. When the DNA is damaged, it may make things grow in an unnatural way. Radiation-damaged cells can and do develop into cancers of all kinds. What's even worse, if the reproductive cells are damaged, the eggs or the sperm, genetic illnesses can be passed on to children and grandchildren, and this danger remains as long as the radioactive waste remains, which is essentially forever. Every radioactive material has a half-life. That's how long it takes for half of the atoms to disintegrate. Now, some have very long half-lives. Plutonium-239, for example, has a half-life of 24,000 years. That's five times longer than the Egyptian pyramids have existed. And when a plutonium atom disintegrates, it turns into another radioactive material that has a half-life of 600 million years. So radioactive waste remain dangerous for millions of years. They are the most toxic waste ever produced by any industry ever. They are essentially indestructible. Countless billions of dollars are planned to be spent to keep these materials out of the food we eat, the water we drink, and the air we breathe. At Hanford in Washington State, just north of California, the radioactive cleanup is estimated to cost more than $300 billion, according to the General Accounting Office. By building more reactors, we're just adding to the existing burden. In fact, you could say the real product of a nuclear reactor is radioactive waste and plutonium, which remains dangerous for millions of years. The electricity is just a little blip, a short-term benefit for a few decades. The radioactive legacy lasts forever.
Gordon, can you put some of this in context? Tell us about the history of nuclear waste, because it takes, as you noted, anywhere from decades to millions of years to lose its half-life toxicity. So, for example, what about the radioactive waste from the very first nuclear power plant built in 1951 in Idaho? Must that nuclear waste be stored forever, or is it to be able to be recycled? And would recycling solve the nuclear waste problem?
Well, Lance, that's a good point, too. The very first reactors, in fact, did not produce electricity. They were built for the express purpose of creating plutonium for atomic bombs. Plutonium is a uranium derivative created in the reactor. It's one of the hundreds of radioactive byproducts that are created inside every uranium-fueled reactor. Plutonium is the stuff from which nuclear weapons are made. Every large nuclear warhead in the world's arsenals uses plutonium as a trigger. But plutonium can also be used as a nuclear fuel. That first power reactor that you mentioned started up in 1951 in Idaho. The first electricity-producing reactor in the world was called the EBR-1. It actually suffered a partial meltdown, by the way. EBR stands for Experimental Breeder Reactor, and it was cooled not with water, but with hot liquid sodium metal. Now, the dream of the nuclear industry was, and still is, to use plutonium as the fuel of the future, replacing uranium. A breeder reactor, such as the first one, is one that can burn plutonium fuel and simultaneously produce even more plutonium than it uses. By the way, another sodium-cooled electricity-producing reactor was built right here in California, and it also had a partial meltdown. In fact, sodium-cooled reactors have failed commercially all over the world, in the U.S., France, Britain, Germany, and Japan. But it is still the holy grail of the nuclear industry, so watch out. There's a lot of pressure right now to get back into the business. To use plutonium, you have to extract it from the fiercely radioactive used nuclear fuel. This technology of plutonium extraction is called reprocessing. It must be carried out robotically because of the deadly penetrating radiation from the used fuel. Most reprocessing involves dissolving used nuclear fuel in boiling nitric acid and chemically separating the plutonium from the rest of the radioactive garbage. This creates large volumes of dangerous liquid waste that can spontaneously explode, as they did in Russia in 1957, or corrode and leak into the ground, as has happened in the USA. A single gallon of this liquid high-level waste is enough to ruin an entire city's water supply. Now, in 1977, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was trained as a nuclear engineer in the Navy, banned reprocessing in the USA because of fears of proliferation of nuclear weapons, both at home and abroad. 3 years earlier, in 1974, India tested its first atomic bomb using plutonium from a Canadian research reactor that was given to India as a gift. The problem with using plutonium as a fuel is that it is equally available for making bombs. Any well-equipped group or criminals or terrorists can make its own atomic bombs with a sufficient quantity of plutonium, and it only takes about 8 kilograms to do so. Even the crudest design of a nuclear explosive device is enough to devastate the core of any city. Plutonium is also extremely toxic, especially when it's inhaled. A few milligrams is enough to kill any human being within weeks through massive fibrosis of the lungs. A few micrograms, that's 1,000 times less, can cause fatal lung cancer with almost 100% certainty. So even tiny quantities of plutonium can be used by terrorists in a so-called dirty bomb. That's a radioactive dispersal device using conventional explosives. Just a few grams of fine plutonium dust could threaten the lives of thousands if it was released into the ventilation system of a large office building. So beware of those who talk about recycling used nuclear fuel. What they're really talking about is reprocessing and plutonium extraction, which opens a Pandora's box of possibilities. And the liquid waste and the other leftovers are even more environmentally threatening, more costly, and more intractable than the solid waste. Perpetual isolation from the environment is still required.
It seems even the way we think about nuclear waste is problematic. We think of it as something we can almost literally sweep under the rug. But that's not exactly going to work. But you've suggested that rolling stewardship is an alternative to deep geologic disposal. Tell us more about rolling stewardship.
Yes, well, it's really trying to get away from the lies. The problem is that there are too many lies surrounding our decision-making, and they give us to false decisions. Rolling stewardship is a concept put forward by the National Academy of Sciences in connection with other long-lived toxic waste like heavy metals and asbestos. The basic idea is that when you don't have a solution to a waste problem, you have to be careful not to abandon the waste. We have to continue to look after it on an intergenerational basis, passing the responsibility, the knowledge, and the resources to the next generation with the object of continually improving safe storage. For the first 30 years of the nuclear age until the mid-70s, no one knew about radioactive waste because the nuclear industry didn't tell anyone about it. People were told that nuclear power is clean, and they believed it. But it was a lie. In the mid-70s, radioactive waste suddenly became public knowledge. Major reports in several countries called for a halt to nuclear power unless the problem is solved. So all of a sudden, the waste problem became an existential threat to the industry. In self-defense, the industry claimed without any real evidence that they had a solution: bury the waste in an undisturbed geological formation. But of course, the moment you dig, it is no longer undisturbed. We've already seen 3 deep underground repositories for lower level nuclear waste fail, 2 in Germany and 1 near Carlsbad, New Mexico. The USA has actually tried 8 times to locate a deep underground disposal site for radioactive waste, and they have failed all 8 times. Here in California, to the credit of Californians, in 1976, hundreds of thousands of people signed the Citizens Initiative to stop any new reactors from being built in the state because there is no waste solution. That was passed into law, and it's still the law. The legislature asked the Energy Resources and Conservation Commission to see if there is a safe disposal method. After 2 years of public hearings, the verdict was no. The commission chairman said in 1978, quote, "We think it probable that safe permanent disposal will never be demonstrated. Excessive optimism about the potential for safe disposal of nuclear waste has caused backers of nuclear power to ignore scientific evidence pointing to its pitfalls." That's the real crux of what we found, that you have to weigh scientific evidence against what is essentially engineering euphoria. End of quote. So rolling stewardship is not a solution, but an acknowledgement that we do not have a solution. Instead of abandoning the waste underground, we should monitor it and make sure it is retrievable. Instead of waiting for the containers to fall apart, we should repair and repackage and improve the safety measures from one generation to the next. Instead of assuming a solution exists, we should recognize that there is no proven solution, and therefore, instead of abandoning the waste, we should look after it. We should keep it monitored and retrievable. Instead of closing the door on research to find a genuine solution, rolling stewardship will keep that quest at the forefront of human consciousness. This may sound idealistic, but in fact, it is simply realistic. The worst thing about self-deception is you end up with a mess, a vastly inferior and dangerous form of rolling stewardship because it was not planned at the outset. One of the worst things about abandoning radioactive waste, which is what the industry wants to do, is that over the very long term, amnesia sets in. Everyone forgets where it is or what it is. So when it leaks out into the environment, and it will leak out sooner or later, no one knows how to even detect it or to deal with it. Rolling stewardship, on the other hand, is predicated on the persistence of memory, the knowledge of these highly toxic wastes and how to deal with them. It has to be kept alive from generation to generation because it remains an ongoing threat. In 2019, I attended a three-day conference in Stockholm about how to warn future generations about the legacy of radioactive waste we are leaving behind. We don't know what language people will be speaking in 2,000 years or in 10,000 years. So how do we warn them? Do we put up a sign saying, do not dig here? Will they understand the sign? And if they do understand it, will they obey it? If I were a future archaeologist who came across such a sign, I would say to my team, hey, let's dig here. The Stockholm conference was an interesting affair. One third of the participants were nuclear scientists. One third were independent commentators and critics, such as myself. One third were librarians and archivists who knew little about radioactive waste, but lots about preserving records, memory, and knowledge. We were all aware that the problem we're addressing is similar to the problem of communicating with extraterrestrial intelligence. How do we communicate with no assurance that they understand any of our languages? So one of the advantages of rolling stewardship is that one can more easily pass on knowledge, information, and advice from one generation to the next, rather than trying to communicate with a completely unknown society of the future. One of the conclusions of this discussion is that decision-making about radioactive waste can no longer be left solely in the hands of the nuclear industry and its captured regulator, the NRC. We have to plan to address it, to address the future. So we need to have a radioactive waste and nuclear decommissioning agency that is independent of all the promoters of nuclear energy, whether commercial or governmental. We need an agency whose sole focus is the protection of people and the environment. We need an agency that communicates openly and transparently with citizens about the nature of the problem and the range of the options. As long as we continue to build and operate nuclear reactors, we're simply compounding an already intractable problem. No matter how fast we bury the old waste, the surface of the Earth will always be prone to catastrophic releases from the freshly produced nuclear waste, which accumulates every day in the core of operating reactors and in the immediate vicinity of those plants. Burial is no solution as long as the industry keeps working. California was wise to pass a law that phases out the production of nuclear waste by banning new plants. It's time for other states and other nations to follow suit.
Gordon, closing statement and thoughts here.
I think it's important to realize that the nuclear industry is seeing they're in bad shape. For the last 25 years, their share of electricity production has been falling, and they're looking to grab money that is set aside for climate change, and that's a waste of money. We should be putting that money into the cheapest and fastest alternatives, and those are clearly energy efficiency, number one, and renewables, number two.
The ever-articulate Dr. Gordon Edwards. He was good enough to provide a copy of his prepared remarks, and we will have that transcript up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 685. People came from all over to participate in this symposium. Here's just one.
I'm Jan Boudar, and I am here from Chicago.
Why did you come all this way for this event?
I wanted to meet the people. I wanted to get the latest information about nuclear waste, and I was invited. having been invited, I decided that I would make the effort to come.
And you're quite involved with nuclear issues in Chicago, is that correct?
Very involved, yes. I'm a secretary at the Nuclear Energy Information Service. Our director is Dave Kraft, and we work on legislation in Illinois and we partner with other environmental groups and try to make them understand the seriousness of nuclear power, which is not very easy because they really don't understand how serious it is. Illinois has more nuclear reactors than any other state in the union, and Chicago is fairly surrounded. We have 11 in our state, and there's two or three up the coast in Wisconsin, and there's two across the lake at Palisades and at Cook, and another one at the end of the lake, at the north end of the lake, called Big Rock Point. Now, Big Rock Point and Palisades are closed, but Cook is still operating. And the one that's closest to Chicago at Zion, Illinois, is also closed. And the one at Zion has 65 nuclear waste casks right on the beach of Lake Michigan.
Not unlike what's happening here with San Onofre.
They're not even at ground level. They are sticking up like bowling pins. There's 65 of them right on the beach of Lake Michigan, and they're the only thing left. All the rest of the power plant has been leveled. It was also, the decommissioning was finished about 2 or 3 years ago, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to its credit, came through and said, wait, you've got a lot of radioactive waste particles out there, and you can't turn this property back to public use until it's cleaned up. Hot particles that had impregnated the soil at Zion, the Zion nuclear power plant, they had impregnated the soil. Nobody knows really how far, but they tried to clean them up in the first 6 inches of soil. And now the site has been turned back to the public use.
What, if anything, did you learn here today that was new for you and perhaps points to a direction that hasn't been tried before that you're going to bring back with you to Chicago?
Well, I learned a lot from Len Herring about how the Navy handles nuclear waste, although I believe most of what he knows is classified and it did not come out. But he did talk about the highly trained people that deal with nuclear power in the Navy, the training they go through and who they are, and who gets into the club and who does not, and the comment that none of this is done in commercial operations.
Jan Boudar. Finally, I spoke with Gary Hedrick, who has been in the forefront of the battle first to close down San Onofre, and then become part of the push to have the radioactive waste handled safely. He, along with Lori Hedrick, are the founders of San Clemente Green. There were many other moments and speakers I want to present to you, and we will feature them on future episodes of Nuclear Hot Seat. We will also have a link up to the YouTube recordings of the sessions on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 684. Our thanks to Bart Ziegler, Rita McDonald, and the entire crew from Samuel Lawrence Foundation for their efforts in putting together this symposium.
Activists, shout out.
This coming week marks the upcoming 79th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan. Back from the brink, and several local and state elected officials will be emailing more than 400 mayors, city councilors, city commissioners, and state senators and representatives, asking them to speak out on behalf of their community to honor the hundreds of thousands who died or were injured, and demand that Washington decision makers get serious about preventing nuclear war and pursuing a world free of nuclear weapons. They are asking us to reach out to state and local officials to ask them to do one of the following. First, issue a statement or proclamation to express solidarity with communities and individuals who have been harmed by nuclear weapons. Secondly, post on social media suggesting a message such as, "What happened 79 years ago to the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki can never happen again to anyone anywhere. Nuclear weapons are a local issue, and my community's voice matters. It's time for Washington decision makers to get serious about preventing nuclear war and pursuing a world free of nuclear weapons." And finally, you can share a crane for the future. You, your organization's staff or volunteers, or your elected officials can fold a paper crane as a symbol of hope and peace as part of the annual Cranes for Our Future initiative, sponsored by our friends at the Nuclear Threat Initiative. A request for involvement from the group Back from the Brink. I've recently found out about two other podcasts dealing with nuclear issues and wanted you to know about them also. Rappaport is a journalist who is concerned by the prospect of the efforts to restart the permanently closed Palisades reactor in Michigan. For a recent program, he interviewed Joseph Mangano, head of Radiation and Public Health Project, on how the Van Buren County, Michigan site of Palisades has moved from a low cancer to a high cancer county since Palisades first opened, something that occurs near many reactors. We'll have a link up to that podcast on nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 685. Then there's Boomtown, a six-part documentary podcast reported and produced by Alex Cowan. The podcast focuses tightly on the Hanford Downwinders, a group of people affected by radioactive waste that was knowingly released from the site. Boomtown's creator, journalist Alex Cowan, said he wanted to understand this divided and complex history about uranium, as well as current questions and pressures to build a new nuclear industry. We will also post a link for that. And our congratulations to Lois Lipman, director of the film First We Bombed New Mexico, which has been accepted into the United Nations Association Film Festival. The festival runs October 17 to 27 in Palo Alto, California, at Stanford University, East Palo Alto, and San Francisco. This year's theme is Shared Humanity. As for Lois and her film, we have been going round and round for months trying to find a day and a time that will work for both of us to be able to record an interview, and we will have one upcoming shortly. We both pledge to that. As for next year's festival, if it follows this year's pattern, the early deadline for submissions will be as of May 2025. You can find out more by going to their website, UNAFF, like film festival, .org. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 30th, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week so you don't miss a single episode, we make it so easy for you. Sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or just go to nuclearhotseat.com. Fill out your first name and an email address in the big yellow box, and every week you will get one, only one. We don't bug you, but we will send you one email with a link to that week's show and a short description of the show's content. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, important, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we will really appreciate your help. Anything you can contribute helps, and we are always deeply appreciative of your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby, Halevi, and Hardest Street Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, dangerously radioactive nuclear waste is forever, which means there's no way nuclear energy is clean, green, or sustainable, no matter what the industry and its high-priced lobbyists say. There you have it. You have just received your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Thanks for being here, and remember, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.